I have started and exited multiple companies. I am an avid investor in early stage companies. I advise some of the hottest startups and have worked with many of the top tech companies across numerous industries. I'm a software developer by trade, but I also have an MBA from Duke University. I seek out companies who defy conventional wisdom to drive innovation in any industry. And in this podcast, I interview the founders of those companies for you. Hello, folks. Welcome to the podcast. I've got a great interview lined up today. With me in the studio is Dane Delaney. Dane is a partner at Bishop Delaney Joyner, a law firm here in Charlotte. This is really a two-for-one interview because not only is Dane a founder in his firm, but he also specializes in startups. So I've got a lot of questions on both of those that I want to get into with him. Dane, thank you so much for joining me today.
Glad to be here, John. We've talked a lot of times, so it's good to do this a little more formally.
Exactly. That's what I tell people the best part about doing this podcast is I get to sit down with people that I admire and spend an hour, hour and a half with them, and it's very rare that you get to do that. So thank you for that.
Nope, it's equal. Glad to have you get a chance to talk to you about these things.
Awesome. So how did you get into working with startups?
So I got into it because in the 90s, I went in-house with tech companies in 91, believe it or not, and tech companies were a new thing back then. But I stayed with technology companies all through the 90s. I was last general counsel of a publicly traded company in South Park. We did year 2000 work, mm-hmm. which was kind of interesting, and we grew the company up to 300 employees and $100 million in market cap and all the way down in 3 years.
Wow.
So it was a fun ride. And since that time, I've started two small firms. I think it's a good structure to help the startups, and I'm continuing with that today.
Great. So do you still have both firms or just Bishop Delaney?
No, just Bishop Delaney.
Okay. Great. So what percentage of your business is early stage companies, would you say?
I'd say it's about 60-70% of my business. I work mainly representing founders and companies that are trying to grow, but I also work with investors. And then the other portion of my business is mainly merger and acquisition work.
Great. I know I've worked with you on both sides of the equation, both the startup and the founder and as an investor. When you talk about merger and acquisition, is that more your clients are buying other companies, or is it your clients are selling? Or I'm guessing it's a mix of the two.
It's very much a mix. I mean, you know, there are companies, there was one last year that had an exit that I started it from when it started and took it all the way through the sale to a large publicly traded company, which is fun to watch it go from kind of cradle to grave in that way.
That's really exciting. Was that a Charlotte-based company?
Yeah.
Okay, cool. It's always exciting to see in Charlotte because we don't have a lot of those kind of exits
right.
to talk
it
about.
Good. It was so good to see.
That's awesome. What do you think are the most common things you do for your clients?
You know, it's really a pretty wide variety. You know, it starts with trying to get the owners together, understand their ownership and the management. And then pretty quickly it goes into helping them with customer contracts and trying to grow the business, employment. Just other dispute issues that come up, helping them structure equity incentive with these high growth companies, that very quickly becomes very important because they've got more equity than they do money. So they need a way to try to incent people to continue to work with them where they can't pay them the same salaries as somebody maybe across the street.
Yeah, it's a very important currency for a lot of startups.
It really is.
That's great. And what I've always enjoyed about working with you and your firm is you've got opinions on the business thing, but you're able to separate this is business advice I'm giving you and this is legal. Because sometimes we just need legal advice from you and other times we need the business advice.
That's exactly right. And I've done this long enough where I'm certainly humble on the business side and the legal side in that, you know, I want to listen to the founder, understand what they want to do, and help them from a legal perspective get where they need to go. I'll give my opinion both on the legal and the business side, but I've also been wrong before on the business side, and I've watched people just do great when things I wouldn't ever thought work, and it's so it's fun to watch that. But I will give my opinions, but I'll listen too.
So how would your answer to the most common things you do for your clients change for different size clients, or are they pretty much the same?
You know, it's pretty similar for different size clients. That's one of the things with my background that I can do is I can kind of start with a company from a pure startup, two people that are getting together, trying to grow a little bit, and just start a concept to growing with them through seed and A and B rounds, and then go on from there. And for the most part, you just get into more complexity as you get larger and you get into broader issues. But in general, all and certainly a large portion of my companies have some type of technology base, and that drives a lot of complexity that it doesn't matter the size of the business, but it does help knowing it up and down the chain because you can help them prepare. Okay, here's what we're going to do here. Mm-hmm. But when you get to the next step, you got to think about this.
Yeah. That's great. And obviously, as they grow, it grows your fees that you're,
charging like to, them. If I can grow my business and my businesses, I know it'll come back and help me.
So in your mind, what are the top things someone should look for in a, when choosing a law firm? And should they only be choosing one?
That's a very dependent question. But the real answer is what the main thing they need to be looking for is somebody that's going to listen to them, understand their goals, and then be able to answer questions to help them meet those goals, whatever they are. That goes back to that last question we were just talking about.
Sure.
And it's for myself, I help the companies with a pretty wide variety of things from the background that I have, but I'm more than willing to bring in the right attorney to do it no matter what the issue is, even if it's not somebody from my firm or even somebody from a smaller firm. It could be a large firm. It's I just help somebody bring in a group that was an attorney really from a large firm who was really a specialist in working with SEC issues and broker-dealer issues, which is a really kind of that's a very specialty type of law.
Sure. Yeah, that seems like something where having expertise with it is important.
Yeah, and I know generally how to help with a lot of things, but there are certain things I would like to bring in the experts on myself.
And I know in the past, in working with you, a lot of times when it starts to feel like it's something that could go to litigation, you've got partners that you like to work with as well.
That's right. And that's what, having worked here for the last 30 years, and I'm from here as well, I know who else in the community does good work with whatever stage company is, and whether it's a startup or if it's a larger company, the answers all may be different depending on where they are in their growth.
It's interesting because I've never really thought of it this way, but it's almost what you hear people say, I'm a fractional CFO or a fractional CTO. It is almost a GC on demand.
What I tell my clients. I'm the outside counsel for them, and I ask them to call me about any legal issue they have. And if I can't do it, I will help them get to the right attorney, even if it's something, you know, like a personal injury question or or a divorce. Mm-hmm. I work with all, you know, I know I've got friends in all those areas and help them make sure they get their legal needs taken care of.
That's awesome. So I think I know the answer now that you've talked through that, but how do you go about competing with larger firms?
I think that the structure of a smaller firm works better for working with startups. The fee structure is obviously a little bit better. For those that have startup attorneys that have done this a long time, like myself, we've done so much of it. We've got the documents to be able to do it pretty efficiently. And so it's less risk than it is with a large firm where the partner may not have as much control about who's doing all the work and trying to get it all collected.
Got it. That's why I've continued to work with you. And even in firms that we've scaled like Level, you were able to grow with us and help us at the very beginning, but even in the later stages. What advantages did the big firms have over you?
Like the example was a specialization in certain areas. Mm-hmm. And that's, there are some really great attorneys that work at those firms. It's just not, they're not built to work with the small startup or even a mid-sized startup. They're built to work with the banks and the rates reflect that. And so, while I'm not inexpensive, people start getting bills from large firms and they really start taking a deep breath and looking at it.
It's some of the rate, and again, I think your rates are very, very fair. They're fair to you, but they're very fair to the client. But The thing that drives me crazy is when you see rates that are sometimes 50% higher and there's two or three of these guys on the phone and I'm like, right. What is this costing me?
That's all you can really think about when that's going on.
Yeah. Well, that's the thing. I'm not worried about every 6 minute increment with when I'm paying one person your rate, but when it's three guys,
right.
At those New York attorney rates,
it adds up quick.
On the flip side, when I'm negotiating with a partner and I've got three what I know are very high paid lawyers, I feel like we're at an advantage because the
it's so funny. That has been my experience for the last 20 years being out in smaller mid-sized firms, is that a lot of times it's me against me and an associate against a whole cadre of attorneys.
Yeah.
And we're if not running rings around them, certainly holding up with them just fine.
Yeah, absolutely. So has the nature of your client base changed through the years?
You know, it really hadn't. It's I came out, you know, to work with startups and then help them grow and move along. Where it may have changed some is that as Charlotte's ecosystem has grown, I have started getting competitors in town. There's some other very good startup attorneys. And I think one of the differences I have a little more experience with the later stage companies than they do.
That's great. So now I'll shift to startups again because you've worked with so many. I guess first off, what's the biggest mistake you think first-time founders make?
The biggest mistake, and I see this pretty regularly, is they don't think they need an attorney at all, and they go online to LegalZoom, or they just do stuff, and they cobble things they fall to get find on the web together, and that just becomes a real problem because then I not only have to fix it, but I have to go back and unwind what they did and then do it correct the second time, which actually in the end ends up really increasing their expenses significantly. And so I think they really need to get a good startup attorney, and not just a good corporate attorney, a good attorney that knows the startup world and how to make their way through it.
Yeah, I think that's an important point. My experience is that it's much cheaper to do it right the first time than when you get that first VC investment.
Well, and that's really, I mean,
or go to exit.
That's always one of my goals, is because that's one of our jobs, is to help the founders really think through the issues both amongst themselves and then later stage investors, so that when those things come up at a later time, we've already thought through it, there's something in the documents about it, or if it's an investor coming in after doing a round, they go, oh yeah, all these legal documents look perfectly normal. There's not stuff that makes them go, whoa, wait, what's that?
Are there things that they ask you for help with that they probably shouldn't?
You know, not that much. I mean, if they ask me for my opinion, that's one thing. I have seen a lot of companies and a lot of business models and seen what I think works and doesn't work. But again, I'm humble enough to absolutely see that I'm not always right about that. And I've seen people go off into directions and just absolutely kill it. But there are some good experiences I've learned and can share with my clients. Especially again in the kind of technology space, I've seen the business models that work and those that don't, understand why one may work better than the other.
Yeah, that's always been valuable in our conversations. So I want to talk a little bit about entity choice. What's the most popular form of entity these days?
So the most popular form, you're going to see usually, is an LLC for a startup. And there are a couple of reasons for that. One is, somebody might go on to the web and read about how West Coast VCs want everybody to set up as a corporation from the very get-go. But the reality is, in this space and in this area, is that setting up as an LLC gives you a lot of the flexibilities like a corporation, but it allows you to be a more tax-efficient, use your losses that you have.
But and you can always flip it because it's just an IRS election, right?
Right. Well, and that's what you and I have talked about this before, is I set up a lot of these as LLCs. And then later, if they get a good investment, $1 million investment, investor says, I want you to become a C Corp, you give them a good thumbs up and it's like a graduation for them, because that means that they're really starting to grow and hit some hurdles. But until that time, it's better to be an LLC. And I've got a lot of very large companies that are LLCs, lots that have raised millions and millions of dollars. And if they sell before they turn into a corporation, that's actually a better tax outcome for the owners.
Yeah, because there's no double taxation.
Right.
Yeah, we were thinking at Level about flipping to flipping the tax election to being taxed as a corporation. we just had Nexus in over 20 states, and we had all sorts of complex reporting requirements. And at the end of the day, our tax return got to about 3,700 pages, and just flipping to a non-pass-through entity would have greatly reduced the complexity. But we had loss, right. And we had accounting issues that we wanted to get through before we right. made that switch.
And that's what it's always. As long as you're doing it in North Carolina, there's some states where it's not as easy to make that flip from one entity to another. But in North Carolina, it's very easy to change entities if you want to. So you're not making a decision for the rest of your life.
Yep.
And the only other the other structure that you see is setting up people as S corporations. And that's a really good structure if you're not going to go out and really try to grow. You're going to start a retail store, and it's just going to be you or you and your wife as the owner or you and your partner. Because there are tax advantages to that, but there are some major restrictions on your growth. The two biggest ones being you can't have an entity as an owner. So like an investment company couldn't invest in you because you're an S corporation. And then secondly, you can't have preferred stock again. Really, stopping
only one
your
class of stock.
Only one class of stock.
So, and I think I heard you can't have any foreign nationals.
Can't have foreign nationals. That's right. The IRS is not going to give you a break on something without taking some things away, and that's what they take away with the S corp.
Interesting. I never heard that was the reasoning for the restrictions on the S corp. What is a disregarded entity? I see that question a lot. To investors at tax time, people say, what is the nature? Is this a partnership, a disregarded entity?
Yeah, and all it really means is both as an LLC, tax is either a partnership or an S corporation. And an S corporation, the taxes, the profits and losses flow down to your personal taxes. And that, again, that's where it's really helpful as a startup, especially if you've got another job or other sources of income and you're running this company, but you're losing money. Those losses drop to your personal taxes and actually will reduce your tax burden because they'll offset that gain that other income you're getting.
Okay. And I think you've already probably mostly answered this, but why are LLCs good for high growth startups?
And the answer is they're really flexible. Yeah. That's really what makes them a good vehicle, I think, for a startup. And again, if you get to the point where you get a investor that comes in and gives you some money, flip to a C corp in Delaware. And
that was my next question. There. Why should I do that? And it's typically going to be when you get that big investor.
Right. And the reason that they want to go to Delaware is because people that do work like I do, like startup attorneys that work with investors, we all know the laws of Delaware. And so you can get an investment from South Carolina or Texas or California, and everybody knows how those are supposed to be structured, how they're supposed to work. And so that's the only reason people will ask me that question a lot. I'm like, no, there's no tax advantage. As a matter of fact, it's a negative tax.
Well, and they have the Court of Chancery or something there. That
right. Well, they have a long history of their courts being able to interpret the corporate laws. Mm-hmm. So you got a really good body of law. You know how things are going to be handled. And it makes it a really great place if you're going to be raising money nationally to be incorporated.
Can you talk a little bit about, in your mind, what's important to put in an LLC's main governing document, the operating agreement?
Yeah, the operating agreement is really important because, as opposed to a corporation, that there are not a lot of LLC laws that are absolutes. They're all except forth in the operating agreement. So that's really your main governing body document for your governance of your company. So you've got to set up the ownership. Do you have one class of ownership? Do you have voting and non-voting? Who are the managers? Typically, the way that LLCs are set up is that they have what are called members that are like shareholders, and then they have managers, which are kind of like board of directors and officers at the same time. And so trying to figure out how the ownership is going to be structured, you know, who's going to have what percentage and how that works, and then also who the managers are going to be and, you know, what are their management limits and what can they do to really try to keep...
Before it goes to a board vote or a shareholder
right, before
vote.
It has to go back to a shareholder vote, because that's a much bigger deal. And, you know, usually I set them up, and most attorneys do these days, where the managers have most of the control, but you'll usually carve out a few major things like buying a company, selling a company, selling more ownership, things like that you have to take out to the other members. And when you do that, that's as you get bigger, that gets to be a bigger and bigger pain. So it's something that you really have to think about. And the investors and the other members have to be able to sign off and feel comfortable that the managers are doing the right thing as well.
Yeah, these are things where my experience has been, and luckily we had an early investor in Level who made us think about a lot of these things. And he was adamant about, no, you need to have an operating agreement that's written for the kind of company you want to be, not right. the kind of company you are today.
And that's really the goal, is you write it and you write it. And it is a living document a lot of times, and mm-hmm. it gets amended over time if you grow. But on top of those two things, you really need to think about ownership, what restrictions on transfer, and then if something happens to somebody on an involuntary basis, you have buy-sell provisions. Because the whole concept of an LLC, if it's taxed as a partnership, especially, is that you're in business who you want to be in business with. You're not in business with their wife. You're not in business with a bankruptcy court that may take over that ownership.
Mm-hmm.
So if there is something like that that happens, that the company and possibly the other owners have a chance to buy it back at that time because they want to be able to choose who they're in business with.
Yeah, that's very important. So you've written before about convertible notes as an early stage funding option. Can you talk about why you like a convertible note?
Sure. And I'll talk about both sides of it.
I get a two for one.
Well, it used to be that the convertible note was a way to avoid a valuation question. But nowadays, almost all investors are going to ask for a cap, which most people equate to somewhat of a valuation. It's not exactly, but that's the way a lot of people equate it. And so if you do that, it's set up so that it's a note until you hit an automatic conversion point. And the issue I've seen over time is if you don't set it up correctly on the front side and give yourself enough time to grow the company and raise the money that you need to automatically convert it, if you get that to that date where it's mature and the investors can call the investment, it can be a real problem. You and I were talking about the fact that I had three companies over the last 3 years have raised millions of dollars each on convertible notes. And some of those started to hit maturity dates. And two of those three companies went under because of the fact that they couldn't continue to raise money. The people were not happy with it. And they had the ability to call those notes, which led to the shutdown of the companies.
Wow. Yeah, I didn't even think about that. It's almost when you put in a cap and you put in a paid-in-kind interest term and you put in a discount, it's almost a more complex valuation in many ways.
Well, it is. And if you're just selling equity and they don't get the money out that they want, it's not going to shut the company down. You got to go raise more money and figure out a way to do it eventually, but they don't have the same leverage over the company staying in existence they do as with a convertible note.
Interesting. Yeah, I've always liked them because I do say it's really hard to add to value a pre-revenue company in many cases.
Right.
But you're right. Like I've seen such a wide difference between caps and between discounts and between the interest that it actually pays that it's
it can be pretty good because the investor, and I have written about this, the investors, they not only get their principal, they not only get it what it will convert in, which is usually around a 20%.
They get a preference, a very strong preference.
Yeah, 20% preference, but they also get that interest. And if, say, it's a three-year note at 10% interest, that means they get another 30% because it over that time. So it's not a bad investment vehicle. You just have to be careful that you're structuring it so you know if it comes to that maturity date, what happens, and everybody can figure a way out that's good for both the investors and the company.
Excellent. Thank you for that. Why else is it good to have an attorney that knows the various investment structures to help you with financing? Many people would think that's more of an accounting question.
Well, and I do work very closely with a lot of accountants, both from just the accounting side and from the tax structuring side. But one of the key things that I think is most helpful to have an attorney that understands investment structures, and especially how they look going down the road, is that you have somebody that can look at them and say, John, that's a pretty normal provision. I know you don't like it, but it's okay. they're not going to back off of that, and that's normal. And
that's 90% of the reason I hire you, Dane, is because I hate reading legal documents, and you're like, this, you need to worry about these two or three. The rest of this is just bullshit.
Right, and that's what, and you look at it, and you go, but these things are important, and you need to think about it, and here's why you need to think about it. Here's what can happen down the road, but probably just as equally is, these are all things that the next investor coming in, the next person who may acquire your company after this investment, will come and look at these things and go, those are all pretty normal things. We understand how that works. Let's not worry about due diligence further on this. Let's move on towards trying to get the investment done.
Okay, I want to pivot or switch gears here again. Say your company gets to a stage where it's ready to be bought. Can you speak to an asset purchase versus a stock purchase when someone is buying a company? And I realize there's tax implications that you may not be as qualified to speak about, but there's also legal ramifications as well.
There are. And, you know, there are some pretty significant tax differences between the two, especially depending on if you're an LLC versus a corporation. But one of the key things with the asset sale, buyers like those typically because they get rid of all the unknown liabilities of the company, and they leave those with the current owners.
But that in an LLC, that or in a C-corp, that triggers a double taxation.
Right. If they sell, right, a C-corp will have double taxation for the owners of the company, which unless they sell their stock. But in an asset sale, which is preferred, that's the way they're going to go about it. And the other things we look for.
Glasses. Got it. Well, I know that when you and I talked in the pre-interview, you said that there are times when a stock sale makes more sense.
Right.
It's always a better answer for the seller.
It is a better answer for the seller. It is, because one of the big negatives with doing an asset sale is that you have to get assignments of contracts oftentimes, especially if you've got large customers. And that can be really hard. Or if you have licensing issues, or if you've got a company that people really want and you're a corporation and you can sell the stock, it's a much better tax issue for you because of that double taxation issue.
Mm-hmm.
And really because it's all going to be capital gains if you're able to sell the stock, and it's a little bit smoother. The buyer on the other side of it is looking at it and going, wow, if I buy a stock, I'm taking all the good and bad of that company, no matter what comes out of the
woodwork.
It's
going to be a longer diligence.
Right, it is, because it's going to be, you know, whatever comes out of the woodwork later, I'm going to be on the hook for. And even though I may have the right to go after the person, I've really got to think about it.
No, it is an interesting one. And as you know, I'm in the process of acquiring a company right now, and we're doing an asset sale. And it was for a lot of the reasons that you just talked about that we chose that approach. But we went through the contracts, and it looks like even with an asset sale, it's we're going to have to get consent from the existing customers to renew anything.
Typically, that's not that big of a deal. There may be some pushback from some certain customers, but usually that's not that big of a problem. And it's one of those things, if worse came to worse, you could always flip it over to a stock sale if you had to. But the only time I've seen it happen once or twice where it was just an absolute issue, and you just have to be able to work through it. But it is part of the process, and it does make the process longer.
So we talked a little bit about owners making acquisitions in that discussion. What are some common mistakes you see owners make when they do acquire companies?
One of the biggest ones I see, there's two big ones that I've learned over time. One is the giving them all the money up front. I'm going to buy your company. I'm just going to give you all this money and you can walk away. I like to keep them on the hook, especially in a relatively short period of time, 12 months, 18 months, through either a note or some type of earnout, so that if something does come up, you have a way to get to that money without actually having to sue them, hopefully, and be a way to actually.
I've seen where they reserve money in escrow until a certain period of time.
Right, and so you reserve part of the price to make sure that things are as they say, and so that they're incented to help you do that. The other thing is a non-legal thing, and it's just making sure that the group you're buying it from is trustworthy. And I don't know how to say it any other way than that, because I've seen most of the really bad situations I've seen come up, the people thought that the people they were buying it from were not particularly ethical, and we couldn't find anything and some high level due diligence and their look at the company. But as time came along, stuff kept coming up that was always problematic, and mm-hmm. then we've got to deal with it on the backside. And even if you have the right to go after them, it's not just an automatic right. You've got to bring a lawsuit.
You're going to spend some money.
You're going to spend some money. It's going to be painful for everybody. And so I think really the more comfortable you are with the ethics and trustworthiness of your buyer, the better it is.
I think that's great advice in most things related to business.
True.
If you don't trust them, you probably need to run the other way. And my business partner that I'm making this acquisition with, we have a rule for our new business, which is don't bring anybody on that you don't want to go have a beer or a coffee with.
That's right. That's exactly it.
So how would your advice change if you're advising the seller? Would it be the exact opposite advice of when you're advising the buyer? Mistakes to avoid?
Well, to some extent it is, and it is a little bit. It is get as much money. Because what you don't want is to have a lot of money hanging out there that you've got to collect from the person, because kind of the flip side.
Yeah.
If you have to go collect it from them, there's no automatic way I have for you to get that money. You're going to have to ask them, ask hard. We can create hooks into them to make it, incent them to do that. But in the end, you may have to sue them to try to get it. And it's that's really important to try to make sure you've got that money up front as much as possible.
No, I think that's great advice. Can you speak of different sorts of equity incentive plans? And this could be either what we've just been talking about from an acquisition perspective, or just the equity incentive plan that you're defining for a founder when they want to use that currency that you talked about that's cheaper in the beginning.
Right.
Although if you get to be a big company, that currency becomes pretty expensive.
It does. And that's really important, because I think one of the things that I've learned over time is that a founder, the first time founder wants to give everybody equity because they don't have them cash. A second time, a serial entrepreneur holds on to that equity like it was their child, because they know that that's really where they make the money in the end.
Well, and the second time, the serial entrepreneur finds it easier to raise money.
It's easier and cheaper
to raise money.
That's so true.
They'd rather give away the cash instead of the equity.
Right, and that's what I do talk to my clients a lot. There's a balance there that they really need to think about, and not just throw equity at people to try to get them to come on. And the equity plans, it's interesting because it's an area that I do a lot of work. When I first got into it, I learned how complex it was, and it runs across a lot of legal areas. But one of the main things you got to worry about is the tax impact of it. Because if people are like, well, I'm just going to give this person part of my company, I'm like, well, you just sold part of it at $1 million valuation.
You're giving them money.
Right. And the IRS looks at that. Instead of giving them salary, you're just giving them compensation. So they're going to be taxed on that. And guess what? There's not money out there
to pay for that. They can't feed their kids with it.
Yeah. That's right. And so that's why you see options or profits interest often, because it's a way you can give ownership to somebody, or you can grant ownership to somebody in a way that they don't have to pay taxes today, and the company doesn't have to pay taxes today. But if they're successful down the line, they would have the opportunity to participate in the upside of it as they go down the path.
Yeah, I've used both of those. What are your thoughts on profit interest versus options?
So in an LLC, there is a way to, and tax is a partnership, there is a way to do profits interest. And it's another form of equity that you can give. And it is important because...
Well, it's economic interest in North Carolina.
It's economic interest, right. It's really an economic interest to... It's just, you get the right to participate in profits of the company. I'm actually dealing with a really complex situation right now. The options and the problem with an LLC and profits interest are they become members, which affects their ability to take salary, which affects their ability to get benefits. And so I have actually shifted over time from profits interest usually to more, you can do options in an LLC. Like I said, that's the nice thing. It's really flexible, and it's a way to get equity to somebody where they don't have tax impact now, but give them some upside as they go down the path. Now, the other thing that I have, it's funny, in the last probably 12 years, And before the last year and a half, I probably had done three or four what are called phantom equity plans, and they're different structures for those. But I'd probably done three or four, and I've done seven or eight in the last year and a half. And I think that's because of the economy being the way it is, and everybody really needs a way to incent their employees, even companies that didn't think they used to need that.
But how is a phantom? Because my understanding of a phantom grant was that you would do an option, and maybe this was just a placeholder I put in my brain, but you do an option or a profit interest grant, but it only has any impact on it only vests on change of control. And so I always thought of that as a phantom.
You can set them up so that it's annual too. The thing is, the real answer, they're just bonuses. They just sound fancier.
Okay.
It's just from the IRS looks at it like a bonus. So it sounds fancier and it makes people think maybe I have kind of an equity ownership. The reality, it's
literally just paying a percentage of the profits as a bonus.
Right, right. And it's and both of them are going to be not taxed as though you're an owner. Mm-hmm. So it's really, the IRS looks at it and says, well, that's just a bonus plan. But you can make it sound really cool with the documents. And it is a way to give somebody part of an ownership. I had probably the biggest one was an S corporation that sold for eight figures that had a phantom plan, and a lot of people up and down the line in that company were able to get pretty good money out because of that.
That's great. Do you have an opinion, and I think you sort of answered this before, but you may have a deeper opinion on it, but whether founders tend to give too much or not enough equity to their key employees?
That's like, usually it's too much up front, and I usually have to talk them down.
What do you think is too much? I realize it probably depends on the situation, but just for the listeners.
The real issue is if they're bringing in somebody really important, like a CFO level or head salesperson, that's where you typically really get into this discussion. And even with that, you're not giving it to them all up front. Usually there's some vesting involved. And so you've got the opportunity to say, and there's some back and forth with that person because they're probably a little bit more sophisticated and have a little bit of knowledge of this too. And so you can say, well, I'll give you, 5%, 10%, depending on the stage of the company and where they are. And then say, I'll give you that much, but, it's got to vest over this period of time so that I make sure that you're there. It's possible in certain situations to have other triggers other than just time vesting. But the reality is, with the time vesting is, if they're good, they're going to still be there at the time it vests. And if they're not, they're probably going to be gone.
Yeah, yeah. No, some of the best advice I got early on at Level was I was trying to hire a head of sales. And Chris Halligan told me, he's like, look, if you, my biggest suggestion is treat this person like a partner.
Right.
And give them real equity, make it vest. He's like, whether it's over a period of time or whether it's over some revenue targets. If you can't, and he said, make it meaningful, make it 5-6%, right, which is meaningful equity.
Absolutely.
And he said, if you can't bear the thought of doing that, that probably isn't your head of sales.
Right, right. That's I talk to people all the time. I think that's the hardest thing to hire for, because if they're a halfway decent salesperson,
they're selling you.
Right, right.
Very interesting. So do you have any advice for people who think about giving equity to every employee? Because that seems to be popular in some circles and not in others. And I've got my own opinions on
that. Right. My opinion on generally no, but again, this goes back to the, can you pay them? Yeah. And it depends on if you're trying to grow a company and you've got a lot of employees and you can't pay them all market wages, it becomes a real pressure on your company if everybody's getting pulled out because they're getting paid $5,000 more by somebody down the street. I typically am not a huge fan of that, but I certainly see the reason for it, and like to leave it in the discretion of the person running the business because they know that business and they know the situation better than I do.
My experience was that very few people really know how to value that equity. And I remember having conversations with people where we had raised money at 5 or 6x the price that a share was granted to, or a unit was granted to them. And they're complaining about a $5,000 raise or lack of a $5,000 raise. And I'm like, really? Are we having this conversation?
I watch this all the time. And in different markets, I have people in the marketing and digital marketing space, those people move quick. So it depends on who they are and the space you're in.
Yeah, it's one that I really have evolved my opinions on that one. I used to think that you should make everybody, and now I even think that it should be the minimal group of people who are truly 100% committed to this thing.
Right, who are really contributing to it. And if it's somebody you can't, it really would hurt you if they lose. They really probably ought to have an equity. And because the whole idea of it is you're trying to make them think like an owner, and that their success is tied to the success of the company, so that if they're working to make everybody successful and they're successful, they'll make some money.
Absolutely. And I guess it really is just a question of, do they understand it, which may have been more on me not communicating it or explaining it correctly, for sure.
Well, it's interesting. What I've done over time is I put in different levels of plans at larger companies. There was a company, the technology company, had 100 people in it. And so for a head of sales, we put in a true equity grant. At the next level, we put in a phantom stock plan. And the next level is like, why don't you just give them annual bonuses?
Yeah.
Just give them a part. Okay, if you have $100,000 in profit, give them 2% of the profit.
Yeah, yeah. No, I like that approach for sure. So you hinted at it a little bit earlier, but I want to shift gears to Charlotte. What has changed in Charlotte through the years in your mind, specific to the tech and the startup scene, obviously?
It's been unbelievable. I mean, I have been around the Charlotte startup scene since the early 2000s, there wasn't a Charlotte startup scene when I started. We all knew each other very well because there were only dozens of us running around then.
Well, Dan Roselli told me in an earlier interview, he said it used to be when you told someone you're an entrepreneur in Charlotte, they were like, ooh, you're in between jobs at the banks.
That's right. And so it's just been fantastic. Dan did a great job pulling Packard Place, and there were a lot of naysayers, but it has provided a central place for people to congregate and meet. And it's great to watch it really take off. It used to be that I knew every company, and if I didn't represent them, I knew them very well and knew the owners. And nowadays I go up there and I like at Sea to South last week, there were a lot of companies I'd never heard of that I was really impressed with.
Yeah, the Seed the South event was really impressive. Thankfully, Sam and Lynn asked me to moderate a panel, and then I got invited to participate in another panel. And I'm in the scene, and I'm fairly active in investing in the scene, but I was just amazed at how the quality of the people that were there, the companies, the investors that are showing up. It's very different than it was. I haven't been in it as long
well,
as
even,
you have.
Well, even in the last 5 years, yeah, 10 yeah. years. I mean, it's amazing. In the last 10 years is when, because it really kind of bumped along. And then 2008 happened, 2009. And I've been telling people at the chamber they need to pay attention to the scene. They were like, the banks are always going to be around. They're going to be good.
Yeah.
And so all of a sudden now they're like, yay, we love startups. We love the startup scene and entrepreneurs.
Exactly. Well, and I've always said it just takes a couple success stories. That's what you really need.
It is. It really does.
A couple success stories. And then that convinces the brilliant, the brilliant developer sitting in the ivory tower at Duke Energy or Bank of America to go follow her passion. And it's much easier to do that when you see an Avid Exchange or a Map right. Anything or a Passport.
And I've talked to a few people, Avid Exchange, because I'm seeing this, I feel like it's a vortex. It's sucking up a lot of talent in Charlotte, which is great. But I have seen a number of people sell companies to actually go to work for them. And what's going to happen is they will eventually have an IPO or some type of sale that's going to throw everybody back out into it. And that's really a great thing to see. And I think it'll be great for Charlotte.
Well, I came from the D.C. area, and there were a couple of examples of those type of companies. AOL was one that pulled it, hoovered up all the talent that they could get. And these people get to learn how it's done, and they get to build the network and everything else. And then it explodes, and they go invest in companies or start companies because now they have capital and know-how.
That's right.
And we haven't had that. We haven't had the mega exit. I mean, I think Map Anything's probably been one of the bigger exits in recent times, but I think Avid could be it. I think Red Ventures could be it. I think Passport could be it.
Right. We've got a number that are right there right now. It's really exciting.
And Map Anything was a fantastic exit to Salesforce for those who don't know, but I think we've got to get to something that's double or triple the size of that to really move the needle.
It always used to be my issue was that I didn't think we had enough mentors in Charlotte. And with people like yourself and a lot of other people in Charlotte, that is one of the biggest things I think to the Charlotte community that has changed is there are people, even if they're not huge exits, they've had some exit, they're willing, they have the time and the ability to get back, and they're starting to mentor the startups, and that's where you're seeing them really start to grow.
I couldn't agree more. And So do you have any favorite resources or events in town for startups? I think I know because I've seen you at a handful of them. But
right. You know, I really like what Innovate Charlotte's doing. I go to Pitch Breakfast, spend some time around Charlotte Angel Fund, Collective Hustle, and what Sam's doing is great. Missing any?
Nope. I mean, I think Pitch Breakfast is where I usually tell people to start because it's the most obvious and most visceral.
Well, and I'll say the other one that I think people forget about is that if you're really nascent and you're really just trying to get in the space and don't know anything about it, it's got a Million Cups.
Yeah.
It's a good start because that really you get to personally participate in it at that point too.
Absolutely. And I think just spend some time at Packard Place. They're going to advertise the events.
And it's not just those. I mean, there are so many events. I just hired an associate recently and was telling her, I was like, I could go to something every single night if I wanted to, that was out there to do.
So not to put you on the spot, but are there any promising young startups you're particularly impressed with?
And that's what I'm interested in your thoughts on this. The two that come to mind quickly, I think what Skipper's doing is great. It's out of here. As far as really earlier stage, obviously people know Payzer and Stratify and
Passport.
And they know those. And then I like the I think you mentioned Stash Wealth.
Yeah, Priya is amazing. And none of those are your clients, I take it. But not that you need to disclose that.
Some of them are, but not all of them. Got it.
And I think the one that I would definitely add is 2U Laundry.
What Alex and Dan are doing is amazing. Yeah, it's great. I agree.
It's crazy. I had him on the podcast, and I felt like such a piece of shit. But, you know, he's 27 years old, and look at what he's done.
He's done a really good job, and it is hard to believe at 27 that he's able to do it. Because I talked to him right when he was starting up, and I was like, boy, that sounds really tough what you're talking about.
But it sounds commoditized.
And they have they're like anybody else, including Skipper, they have pivoted like heck over time to make it work.
Yep. No, absolutely. They've been impressive. And there's one I've got my eye on. I know the founders not well, but I've spoken with them a couple of times, Rent Ready, and they've just raised some real money, and they've got a really unique commercial real estate solution.
Yeah, like I said, the more we talk about it, the more I keep going, oh, I forgot about this one. About that one. There are a number that I'm really interested in watching.
There's one that I invested in fairly recently called Next Bar, NXT Bar. It's a younger guy named Richard. He's probably not 27. I mean, I'm so old now that they all look young, but I would guess he's 25 maybe on the high end. And he was an investment banker, and he advised a couple of very large, like $500-600 million transactions of bar companies, health bars to large food CPG companies. And, he was like, well, he had healed himself through a ketogenic diet. And he said, I'm going to create a ketogenic bar. And I put some money in. You know, I thought it was a good concept, but it's also not an industry that I understand. But he just, in half the amount of time, so he bought inventory that he thought would last him, I don't know, 6 months. And instead it lasted him 3 months. And it was the number one product on Amazon in the health category.
That's good.
It's just amazing. So I think there's a handful of those that are out there, which is really exciting.
Sometimes it's what you and I know. So oddly enough, I've got some investors that I know that invest in the shopping space. And so Shopee did well at the event last. And so I introduced them to these investors because that's actually a huge space. And very few people know much about that space. But it is really interesting what they're doing. And they can find some opportunity there. Just because of market size kind of issues.
Absolutely. And that's what I'm seeing with Next Bar. They sign up one Whole Foods or one Delays or any of these big name. And you get a little bit of shelf space, you can go a long way.
You really can.
And I think the Good Kitchen has started getting shelf space, if not at Whole Foods, then at another big name. And that's really exciting to see because it is all about that distribution. Do you do early stage investing yourself?
Not directly, and it's intentional because I have a lot of clients that ask me, will you take some equity for what we do, or you invest in us? And I always worry that the investors will look at me and say, well, is he making this decision based on his investment, or he's just a true advisor trying to look out for the best of everybody in the company? And I take a lot of risk with these companies as I'm starting to run up bills and taking long periods of time before I'm paid. I may do that more of that as I get down the path with companies that I don't represent, but not to date.
Got it. That makes a lot of sense to me. Can you comment on any opinions you might have on investing through a fund versus investing by yourself or with a small group of friends?
You know, I think if you're just starting and you're coming out of a bank, or you're coming and you just don't know this world at all, I think starting with a fund, whether it's Venture South or whether it's Charlotte Angel Fund, is a great way to go.
Queen City Fintech has a fund now.
Right. I mean, I think that's really a great way to go.
Well, those guys get to see every deal.
Right.
And you may not be able to do that as an individual. No. I'm very fortunate where I think I see most of the deals in town.
Right.
Or not most, but most of the deals that I would want to see. But I think that that's a really hard, you know, I've been in this startup scene for 10 years now. Exactly, so it's easier for me to find a deal. It's funny though, because Rob Cummings, who we both know, he could do it himself or he could do it with a fund. And the reality is he does both. So it's not, I guess, an either or proposition.
Well, and that's, so like Charlotte Angel Fund, they see a lot of deals. I go to a lot of their meetings. I don't go in there and go, wow, every deal's great.
Yeah.
And deal flow as an investor is really the key. I think if you are going to do it individually and you're going to try to only invest in one or two, it's really tough. If you've got people that you know, like John, like Rob, that know the space, have lived the world, it's a good way to go.
Or Steve, who introduced you and me. If you can invest alongside a media, hey, I got a clue for you. If he decides to invest, put some money.
Right. And these are, it's just because they have the experience and seen the good and the bad and the ugly and a way to try to figure out what's going to be, what's going to help. And I think if you're going to do it, that's why the fund is kind of good, is investing in a lot of them. The earlier it is, the less chance there is of success. I mean, the earlier you are, if you're going to get 1 in 10, you're doing pretty good. And it's hard to tell.
Yeah. No, that's interesting. Cause I tell people, someone asked me the other day, like, hey, I've got 50,000 that I want to invest in startups. And I was like, yeah, my suggestion is you're only going to be able to do one or two of those, and chances are very good that you're going to piss it away. Why don't you go take a class on options investing? And that's probably a better way to get an alternative investment.
Or doing it through the funds, because, yeah. I mean, it's just, I have seen companies I thought were absolutely no way to miss just fall apart, and I've seen companies I thought were terrible try to pivot, add people and stuff, and just do great. Yep. So it's really tough.
Can you talk to why or why not you might advise an investor to create their own LLC or other entity for investing?
Well, yeah. I mean, that's where, especially if you're not going to do it through a fund and you're going to do it individually, maybe if you're investing in one, you don't need it, because as a passive investor, you don't have
fiduciary duties
and obligations to other people that you might have if you were actually working in the company. But otherwise, setting up an LLC and then using that to invest in the company does give you another level of protection as you're going down the path. And you know, these companies get involved with lawsuits sometimes, because if things don't work out, investors are unhappy, and sometimes lawsuits happen. That's just the world that they live in. And so that is another layer of protection between you and your investment.
Well, you mentioned you didn't refer to it as GPTP, but I think that was the concept you were talking about, where there's a guaranteed payment to partners. So if I own a company and I'm on the payroll, I can't be paid through payroll. I have to be paid through GPTP.
That's right.
And my experience has been that if you own your shares through another LLC, then you get paid through payroll. Some people prefer GPTP because you hold your money for a quarter.
Right. But if you're providing them services, that makes a ton of sense.
Yeah. But for most people, it's a pain in the ass to be paid on GPTP. You've got to reserve your own payroll taxes. You've got to pay your own taxes. You've got to estimate your taxes on a quarterly basis.
Right. And you got to hope the company can at least pay those taxes, because otherwise you're coming out of pocket and you don't have any cash to do it.
Yep. Exactly. Well, this has been great, Dan. Is there anything I haven't covered that you think we should leave the listeners with? Or
no, I think we've covered it pretty well. I mean, I think, like I said, going back to the very beginning of it, it's just important to get somebody involved early in the company from the legal side that understands the stuff that can help you out. They don't have to, you know, be the biggest firm in the world and help you through every question, but there are a lot of good startup attorneys in Charlotte that can help you through these issues.
And I can't echo that enough. I'm not somebody who is litigious or call the lawyer on every little detail, but I can tell you that having a good partner, whether it's, and I remember calling you the first time we had an HR issue, for example, and just having somebody that you call rather than going to the yellow pages and trying to find a litigator in the HR space, or IP, or just having somebody who can kind of quarterback is really important. But to your earlier point, if that's going to be $600 or $700 or $800 an hour, you might not make those calls when you probably should.
You would think about it a little more.
Yeah. Well, this has been great, Dane. Thank you so much. And look forward to having you on again. We'll probably have something come up in Charlotte where we want to talk about the legal ramifications. But thank you for joining me for the first time.
No, thanks for letting me on here. And I've enjoyed working with you. And it's a great space to work in. It's really fun to watch these companies succeed and grow. And it's, you know, I have one of my friends that's a litigator. Is like, he looked at me once and he was like, so if you have a problem, you call me and everybody's unhappy. But if you want to grow your company, call Dane.
That is so true. I didn't realize that that's why you always dump it off when it's the litigator. Awesome. Well, cheers, Dane. Thanks again. Cheers.
Thank you.
All right. Bye-bye.